KPCW News Time is 8:06. You're listening to the Local News Hour. I'm Roger Goldman. And everybody wants to know what's going to happen in the weather this week as the snow is coming down. On the phone, we've got ABC4 Weather Center. Good morning.
Good morning. This is Seth. I would love to give you guys the weather. It's looking pretty active up there already. You've probably already seen a little bit of snow. About 4 to 8 inches is going to be possible for today. And then overnight, you could get another 1 to 3 inches. It'll be a little bit breezy, and then the high today is going to be right around 37 degrees. Overnight, the low is going to drop down to 25, and then it warms up just a little bit for tomorrow, but we still have snow expected. Saturday, you could get 1 to 2 inches up in Park City, but Saturday night, it looks like a lot of that will clear out or turn to more of a rain-snow mix. And then Sunday, we have another system rolling on through, so very busy week. Sunday, there's going to be a chance of rain before 8 o'clock in the morning, and then between about 8 in the morning and 11 in the morning on Sunday, there's a chance of rain and snow, and then it'll turn to rain again on Sunday. And then Sunday night, that precipitation holds on, and it turns to snow with about 1 to 3 inches possible for your Sunday night. Still a little far out to say for sure, but that's what it's looking like right now. And then by Monday, those snow showers do hold on, but Monday night, it clears on out. It will be cold. The cold front moves through, so the high on Monday is going to be 30 degrees. But it clears on out by Tuesday afternoon, which means that your New Year's Eve and your New Year's Day are going to be fairly nice, just a little bit chilly.
Okay. Looking further down the road to the extent you can, you know, we've obviously not had the kind of snow we'd like so far this year. How do things look in longer range? Do you see anything in the next couple of weeks? Any more systems coming? I know it's hard to predict.
It's a little hard to say right now, but I'm not seeing anything until another 10, 12 days from now. And even then, looking out that far ahead, anything could change. Another thing that you guys should be looking out for is if you want to go backcountry skiing in the Park City area, you're going to need to stay off of slopes any steeper than 30 degrees, and you need to bring a buddy because the avalanche risk today in the mountains is very high. We've already had somebody rescued from a buddy in the Wasatch Mountains, so it's really important that you stay safe out there.
Well, thanks, Seth. After a brief break, we're going to talk to the Utah Avalanche Center to get a little more detail on that. Have a good weekend.
You too.
Well, let's follow up on that point about the danger in the backcountry. On the phone, we've got Abby with the Utah Avalanche Center. Good morning, Abby.
This is Greg, actually.
Greg, you don't look like Abby at all. I'm very sorry. It's radio, you know?
thanks for having us. And huge, I did not catch the name of the meteorologist.
His name is Seth.
Huge shout out. Yeah, huge shout out and thanks for mentioning the avalanche danger. So we have issued, the Utah Avalanche Center has issued an avalanche warning for the mountains from Logan, Ogden, Salt Lake, down to Provo. And this includes the Park City Mountains as well. We have a high avalanche danger. I think right now this morning we're probably at considerable, but we have some weather coming in. You just heard that. We're expecting heavy snow, periods of heavy snow today, and especially strong winds. So that's really going to change things. We've been talking all winter long. We have this weak, unstable snowpack, primarily on the northerly facing slopes, although this time of the year, because the sun is so low, there's a lot of northerly facing slopes. So anything facing west through north through east has this weak, sugary, loose, unstable snowpack. We have just been waiting for the right enough load to give us widespread avalanche danger. Over the past month, we've had some wind, some snowfall, and we've had avalanches, but I think this is going to be different. We're expecting avalanches, both natural human-triggered avalanches. So we're going with a high avalanche danger at the upper elevations on slopes facing northwest through east. Considerable danger elsewhere. I think at the low elevations, we will have a moderate avalanche danger. So asking people just to avoid those slopes steeper than 30 degrees on that north half of the compass. If you do trigger an avalanche, it could be 2 to 4 feet deep, hundreds of feet wide. And, it's just so, the snowpack is so unstable, it's so tricky right now that you may not get warning signs. Like, it just may be too late by the time you know. So, just asking people to step back. It's great. We finally have the snow. We've been waiting for this. More snow this weekend. We're going to have some periods of heavy, dense snow. In the end, this is going to be good for us. It's going to improve skiing and riding and traveling conditions, which is great. We all want that. And it's also going to ultimately help strengthen and heal our snowpack. But right now, folks, just got to take a step back.
Just to remind our listeners of the adjectives we attach to the levels of danger of avalanche. I mean, we've used considerable, we've used high. What are the total number of levels?
Yeah, no, thank you. I appreciate that. So the North American Avalanche Danger Scale has 5 ratings. It goes from low, moderate, considerable, high, to extreme. So we use these adjectives as specific danger levels. And they actually have 3 different components to them. One of them is just travel advice, how we're telling people to travel through the mountains. Also the likelihood, as well as how large these avalanches are going to be. And so at a considerable avalanche danger, we're saying that human-triggered avalanches are likely. At a high avalanche danger, they're very likely. And it also, also matches how large these things are going to be. And the travel advice is we're just telling people right now that travel in avalanche terrain is not recommended, and that matches a high avalanche danger.
Okay, thanks, Greg. Have a good weekend and be safe out there.
Yes, thank you so much. We appreciate your help.
Melina Stevens is stepping down after 4 years as a Summit County Council member. KPCW's Connor Thomas reports she's remembered as a calming voice amid conflict.
Council Vice Chair Tanya Hansen reads a proclamation honoring Stevens, the current chair, December 11th.
Whereas, as she leaves the County Council, Melina's colleagues and Summit County staff will remember her as a calming voice in the midst of conflict and controversy, a fierce advocate for families and the workforce, and someone who always thanked and recognized county staff for their hard work and accomplishments.
It was Stevens' colleagues' turn to thank her at the penultimate Summit County Council meeting in 2024. The tone was cordial, and Stevens quietly smiled as each of the other council members and a few staff shared their congratulations. The Pinebrook resident took her seat on the council in 2021 after prevailing in the Democratic primary over fellow Snyderville Basin Planning Commissioner Canis Hart. He joined her on the council 2 years later.
I think I'm still in denial. I just don't believe you're actually done yet. I think you're going to surprise us with some incredible service after this.
Stevens, who is an agent with Windermere Real Estate, has made a career out of public service. She earned a master's degree in public administration at the University of Utah after completing an undergraduate degree at Brigham Young University. Stevens went on to work in disability services and as a victim advocate for Park City Municipal, then as the Park City Police Chief's executive assistant. Here's Summit County Attorney Margaret Olson.
I have learned from being your colleague, and I have greatly relied upon your friendship.
Stevens served 2 terms on the Planning Commission, including as chair, and 1 term on council. She was council vice chair in 2023 and chair in 2024. The Summit County Council has not chosen next year's chair or vice chair yet. Whomever's elected will run weekly meetings and make decisions about items on the agenda. Stevens says she's grateful for the current council and says it was a place of civility even during disagreements.
Having a council that just agrees on everything, I think, is just as dangerous as having a council that can't agree on anything, because we have constituents that believe very differently and that have different varying opinions.
This year involved granular and at times tense discussions about a Salt Lake City developer's controversial housing proposal for Kimball Junction. Stevens was involved in parallel conversations with the Utah Department of Transportation about redesigning Kimball Junction's traffic flow. In addition to her council work, Stevens was a founding member of Summit County's Criminal Justice Coordinating Council, created at the end of 2022 to comply with state law asking counties to produce a plan to address crime. Stevens also served as a board member for High Valley Transit and represented Summit County in Utah's delegation to the 2024 Olympic Games in Paris. Stepping into Stevens' seat on the council in January is Mountainlands Community Housing Trust housing advocate and former Park City High School teacher Megan McKenna. It will be McKenna's first time on the council. Connor Thomas, KPCW News.
Coming up, I'm going to get the chance to chat with Rabbi Jonathan Hecht about Hanukkah. Then we'll have an interview with Wyatt Woolley of UDOT reviewing projects here in the Wasatch Back in 2024. We're going to finish our hour with a conversation with Lauren Gustis of the Salt Lake Tribune, looking back at some of the big stories of the year. Please stay tuned. So dozens gathered on Park City's Main Street Wednesday night to celebrate the start of Hanukkah. The Grand Menorah in Miners Park was lit around 5:30 p.m. The lighting of menorahs in city streets and parks has become more prominent in recent years in countries around the world, according to the Associated Press. A menorah parade is scheduled to be held on Saturday at 7 p.m. and will begin at the top of Main Street and proceed downhill to Park Avenue, ending at Mariners Hospital. Here to explain a bit about the history, significance, and traditions of the holidays is Rabbi Jonathan Hecht of Temple Har Shalom here in Park City. Happy Hanukkah and welcome to Mountain Money, Rabbi.
Well, thank you, Roger, and thanks for having me on the show.
So, Rabbi, let's start with the basics. What does the term Hanukkah mean, and what is the historical basis for the holiday?
Well, Hanukkah, the word actually means dedication, and the holiday is talking about the rededication of the temple after the Maccabees were able to defeat the Assyrian Greeks and clean out the temple and rededicate it. The word Hanukkah is also used when we hang a mezuzah, the little box that has the prayer in it that you see when you come into a Jewish home. It's also dedicating that space as a place where Jewish activity happens.
So can you flesh out a little bit of the history? In other words, what was going on geopolitically in Israel at the time of the Maccabees?
The Maccabees, the best way to explain it is that Hellenism, which is started with Alexander the Great and the spread of Greek knowledge, thought, and influence of its cultures was spreading throughout the world. Following Alexander the Great, the Greek Empire was divided up into different regions, and one of the areas that took over was Assyria, just north of where the state of Israel is today. And the king Antiochus Epiphanes decided that it wasn't enough to spread Greek culture. They were going to force Greek culture onto the minority groups that were in the empire. And that's what led to the Jewish revolt led by Judah Maccabee and his brothers.
And the central story that leads to the notion of eight nights and eight candles, can you explain that?
That is a tradition or a teaching that came from the rabbis. It's not found in the Book of the Maccabees, which is part of the Apocrypha. It is found in the Talmud in the section that deals with the laws of the Sabbath. Of course, on the Sabbath, we light Shabbat candles. So they begin a discussion of why do we celebrate Hanukkah and how do we light those candles? And they talk about how that's where the story of the cruse of oil that was found after the Maccabees cleaned out the temple and reestablished worship there. They were only able to find one cruse of oil enough for just one day of lighting the menorah, but they went ahead, lit it anyway, and it burned for an additional 7 days. So the 8 days of the miracle of the burning of the candle leads to us lighting candles to publicize that miracle. That is a story and a teaching of the rabbis.
So by saying, you're drawing a distinction in the sense that it's almost more of a commemorative acknowledgement of what happened rather than something that's rooted in historical fact.
The historical fact is really found in the apocryphal texts, and the rabbis who were living for centuries under Roman rule wanted to downplay the military fighting and instead wanted to focus on the miracle of the oil.
And so what are some of the ways that the holiday is celebrated today?
This is a holiday, as a number of Jewish holidays, are celebrated primarily in the home with the lighting of the menorah on each eve. The holidays we're about to be entering into, we're on the second day, we're going to be entering into the third day of Hanukkah. Tonight we will light three candles, and we celebrate it really at home with the eating of special foods, the lighting of the candle, and the singing of some of the songs.
Okay, so a typical evening in a Jewish home that's celebrating Hanukkah would obviously include the lighting of the candles. What are some of the songs that are typically associated with the holiday?
There are some of the songs that are sung about Hanukkah. There's a song that comes from the liturgy that talks about Al-Hanisim for the miracles that God performed for us in ancient times in those days. There's a song that we sing, Ma'os Tzor, which talks about how God helped us reestablish the worship in the temple. And then there are some fun songs about the dreidel and things like that.
And you've mentioned the dreidel. Our discussion wouldn't be complete if you don't explain a little bit about the dreidel, which many Americans only know about because they heard it in the famous Hanukkah song by Adam Sandler.
Yes, that's true. It's a great song, by the way.
So tell us about the dreidel.
So the dreidel is a spinning top, and it has Hebrew letters on four sides. In outside of the land of Israel, it's got the Nun, the Gimel, the He, and the Shin, which stands for the Hebrew words of Nes, miracle, a great miracle, Nes Gadol, Haya, was happened, Sham, happened there in the land of Israel. In Israel, the dreidel says, Nes Gadol Hayapo, a great miracle happened here. And a different thing happens every time you spin the dreidel, whether or not you have to put some Hanukkah gelt, some money, which we really use chocolate coins today, into the pot, and whether or not you win and take part or all of the pot.
No discussion of Jewish holidays could possibly complete without talking about food. Talk to us a little bit about the traditional foods associated with Hanukkah.
So, of course, the miracle of the oil and burning leads us to eating foods that are fried in oil. And so over time, different traditions have developed in different places. The potato pancake, which really comes out of the European experience. They didn't have potatoes in the land of Israel. although they did have oil, but they didn't have potatoes. So potato latkes, potato pancakes are used throughout the world today. And of course, jelly donuts, which became very, very popular with the establishment of the State of Israel. The jelly donuts, of course, are fried in oil. Today in the land of Israel, starting in September, you can go to different bakeries where they make unbelievably elegant donuts and all different kinds of decorated with all different kinds of fillings, and the bakeries have contests, and it's a really big deal in Israel. So it's very popular food, and we eat them today. You could come to Temple Har Shalom tonight. We're going to be serving some beautiful beignet that we ordered for today, filled with jelly.
So we have jelly beignets tonight.
That's right. Okay. It's going to be wonderful.
And Rabbi, before we go, how significant is the holiday from a religious perspective relative to the other holidays in the Jewish calendar?
Roger, that's a fantastic question. There are two minor holidays on the Jewish calendar that go back to olden times, and that's Purim and Hanukkah. And the reason that these are minor holidays is that they're not mentioned in the Bible. Purim is mentioned in the Bible, but Hanukkah is not mentioned in the Bible. Neither of these are mentioned in the Torah. So they don't go back to ancient times, meaning all the way back into the early period of Israel. And that's why there are minor festivals, but they are, you know, widely observed, both holidays. And both holidays, by the way, have spinning toys that we play with, either the groger, the noisemaker on Purim, and the dreidel on Hanukkah.
All right. Are there any other sort of significant traditional celebrations that we've left out of our discussion?
Well, of course, there are some more modern holidays that we remember, the Independence Day in the State of Israel, and a number of other observances. Of course, families have bar and bat mitzvahs, and we're always celebrating weddings. Judaism is a holiday. Judaism is a religion that is really filled with all kinds of joyous celebrations.
We've been speaking with Rabbi Jonathan Hecht of Temple Har Shalom about Hanukkah. Tonight they'll be lighting three candles for Hanukkah?
Yes.
All right. So happy Hanukkah, happy holidays, and we'll be right back after this. Thanks, Rabbi.
Good morning. I'm KBCW's Grace Dorfler. Joining us this morning is Wyatt Woolley, the Utah Department of Transportation's Region 3 Communications Manager. Wyatt, good morning.
Good morning.
Thank you so much for joining us. Wyatt's here to share some updates from the Utah Department of Transportation for 2024, what's been going on across the Wasatch Back, and what's ahead for 2025. Wyatt, since you mostly deal with Wasatch County, let's start there. Obviously, the Heber Valley bypass is one of the biggest stories for locals. Could you give us a little background on what exactly this bypass is meant to do?
Yeah, sure. You want to start with the big one? Let's go for it. The Heber Valley bypass is the whole idea of the corridor is to address and enhance mobility through the Heber Valley and to improve the operation of Heber City Main Street. So there's two basic goals or needs that we're trying to meet there is regional traffic through the valley and local traffic through the area and to help relieve the traffic problems on Main Street.
Got it, yeah. And recently UDOT has kind of recalibrated their timeline based on some new traffic studies. So what's going on there?
Well, we're currently in our screening process right now. We should have something to give out in spring with our revised screening alternatives. What we did, we had those five alternatives, if you remember, and we kind of narrowed those down to four. And then because we decided that they should have an at-grade option, which is intersections, or a not-at-grade or free-flow, which is interchanges, that basically we have eight alternatives now.
Mm-hmm. And so for folks who might not be as familiar, free flow would be kind of like an overpass and on-ramp type of situation, correct?
Yes, that's correct.
Yeah. And tell me a little bit about the pros and cons of each. It seems like one would be a little faster, but one might be a little more difficult to construct or have a greater environmental impact.
Oh, yeah, for sure. The at-grade or intersections, what we're used to with signaled lights, it would be slower. It would be have a smaller footprint, so we wouldn't have to take as much area for where the interchanges would be. The free-flow option would be interchanges, what we're used to, like on I-15 with overpasses and underpasses, and it would just flow a lot faster. But, of course, with interchanges and all that, it's much more expensive.
Right. And just could you give us a general sense of where those they're eight, but, you know, there's four essential routes. Could you give an overview of where exactly those would be constructed?
Let's see, how do I describe this? So we have basically two that go up North 40 and two that go off to the side through the North Fields. And then those options would be either free flow or at grade. So that's your eight.
Mm-hmm. And some of those options that reconnect to 40, that would require widening 40 as well, is my understanding.
Yes, it would require widening of 40.
Gotcha. And how's the community responding to this updated timeline and, you know, all of the changes that UDOT's been announcing? It seems like things are going a little faster now.
Yeah, we're trying to move as fast as we possibly can. Everyone is anxious. One thing that everyone can agree on, something needs to be done. We just can't agree on how or what that should be, which is why our NEPA process is so thorough and why it takes so long, because we're trying to mark off every box, cross all of our T's, dot all of our I's, and make sure that we're getting the best alternative forward for everyone. And that's why we have eight, and that's why in next spring we will be going to the Heber Council and the City Council as well to show them where we're at.
Mm-hmm. And one of the things that UDOT has pledged is, you know, more communication with the Heber Valley and everybody who's invested in this project happening. Where can people learn more about what's going on, or where can they find updates?
Well, I suggest you go to the website at hebervalleyeis.udot.utah.gov. We've updated it just recently. So we meet regularly, and we meet with the city and the council regularly. But for the public, their best shot is to go to the website where we keep everything up to date.
Gotcha. Well, thanks, Wyatt. Looking at other projects across the Heber Valley, safety on US 40 is a big concern in the meantime while we're waiting for that bypass to be built. Could you talk a little bit about what UDOT's doing to improve safety on 40?
Yeah, so we do have a project that we've been talking with the Wasatch Council along with the city about US 40 north of 40. So think of just north of that restaurant there. I think it's Back 40 Ranch House Grill. We want to put in a median in the middle in certain sections all the way up to SR32 where it connects up there. The reason being is because we've had some head-on collisions and some serious incidents on US 40 in this section, and we realized if we put a barrier in there, it should reduce those serious conflicts.
Yeah, and I understand in the past few years we've had some serious injuries and even a fatality on that stretch. So it sounds like those barriers would go a long way to reducing that kind of serious collision.
Yes.
Yeah. Anything else that you want to mention for the Heber Valley projects going on lately with UDOT?
Well, we got lots of projects in there. We do have, the US 40 going a little farther south out towards Daniels. We're widening the lanes there, and we're going to improve. There's going to be an intersection near Airport Road right there. And so we hope to have that improved, and that should help improve mobility through that area.
Mm-hmm. Very nice. And that obviously is becoming more important as the area continues to grow. Looking to the north, I guess, what's UDOT's general approach when you're trying to improve traffic in an area that's already really crowded or built out? You know, I'm thinking of in Summit County, we've got that Kimball Junction intersection. It's already pretty crowded, but how does UDOT try and strategize ways to make traffic flow a little better in an area like that?
Well, they just finished up some improvements there, and I don't know if you've driven there recently, but it's much better. One way we can do that is by improving the interchanges where people and the off ramps where people turning off. So that junction at 248, like I call it like the south entrance to where I go into Park City. That intersection is greatly improved. There's another turn lane there, so it allows more traffic to go through and flow through, because we realize the Wasatch Back, people live in both areas and work in both areas, and there's a lot of commuters in between. So we try to improve the roads as best we can in those intersections through the area.
Mm-hmm. And what are you thinking in terms of upcoming projects in Summit County for 2025?
They have lots of things that they're always looking at. We're looking at some freeway striping. They're looking at some pavement and improvements throughout the area. And they're also looking at some wildlife fencing a little bit farther north of that near, what is that place called? Near Echo Reservoir, you know, that intersection kind of that goes up if you keep going up north or turn right and you go up 80. We have a lot of wildlife that tries to go through that area, and so they're going to put in some fencing around that kind of spaghetti bowl interchange area right there to help prevent conflicts with wildlife.
Okay, very nice. I'm sure the wildlife will be happy about that too. I want to go back to the lane lines that you mentioned. I was actually just chatting with a coworker about this, and maybe you have to be a little bit of a transportation nerd to enjoy this, but it sounds like you guys have come up with these higher contrast lane striping to improve visibility and prevent trucks from or snowplows from scraping off that paint in the winter.
Yeah.
Could you explain a little bit what's going on with those?
So there's lots of different types of striping that do. We have the regular paint that everyone's familiar with, and that's what they think most of us do. But we also put down thermoplastic and some other elements that we put down. And to put those down, it's basically a tape that we put down, and it has glass beads in it, so it's reflective. So when your headlights shine off of it, it's much, much brighter. But we have to groove those in, and then we put the tape down, and the grooves allow plows to go over it without scraping it off. It's a lot more expensive, but it's also a lot better for contrast. They're also a lot wider. They also have, some of them have like a black stroke around it with the white line that's really wide. I like those a lot. And those are also the tiger tails, which are white and then a long black line. So when the light's reflecting off the road certain times of day, you may not see the white lines as well, but you'll see the black. So it's a much higher contrast, easier to see for drivers, and people seem to really like it.
Mm-hmm. And so that seems like it would improve safety in, you know, all times of year, all times of day or night. Where in the Wasatch Back could UDOT be adding these?
Well, we're doing it up 80. I know that we're doing that out on mostly parleys and that way through that area. But we're trying to do it everywhere that we can. So we will be anywhere we put in a new road or a new area, we look to see if we can add that striping.
Mm-hmm. Very cool. Well, that's good to know. And then in terms of repaving, that seems to be one of the other perennial things that UDOT needs to deal with. I understand you guys have a nice new asphalt that you're using for a lot of this repaving. Could you tell us a little bit about that, and does it help UDOT repave less? Does it extend the life of the road?
It does extend the life of the road. We have a hot mix and a stone mix matrix that we use, and we also do slurry seals and things like that to help enhance the roads to keep them lasting longer. We want our roads to last as long as possible, but we also want to stay ahead of it, so we will often try to get on top of it a little bit earlier, and we look at the numbers and we try to see, is it better just to grind it down now and to put in a stronger asphalt mix now? And so we try to do that when we can afford to do it. And we try to have our roads last 7 to 9 years before we have to re-asphalt and grind it down, which is a long time, and we understand that, but we want to stay ahead of it. So if you do see it, our guys out there working and they're doing that, remember, they're doing it for you. They're doing it for everyone who drives on the road. So please be safe out there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, thanks for that reminder. Any other safety reminders you want to share with the public, Wyatt, as, you know, especially as we're heading into this slippery time of year on the roads?
Oh, for sure. We always want people to watch out for each other, no matter what time of year, but especially this time of year when the storms start coming. Just to remind everyone, we always tell people to drive to the conditions of the road. And that means if it's raining, if it's snowing, if it's sleeting, if it's icy and cold out, you really need to slow down and watch out. You need to drive to the speed that the road allows you to go. Just because it says 70 miles per hour doesn't mean you should drive 70 miles per hour. You need to give yourself enough room in front of the person in front of you. You need to pay attention to the road and to your other drivers. So one last thing I would recommend for everyone is to stay off the phone and pay attention.
Mm-hmm. Good reminder. Well, thank you so much for that, Wyatt. Anything else you want to add about what UDOT has coming up in this new year?
I don't know if you've heard, but we have something called the Utah Trail Network, and that's fun.
Very exciting. So UDOT's kind of helping out with some of those alternative or more active forms of transportation too, then?
Actually, we are doing it. So they will be UDOT Trails. It's a new program for us. We call it the Utah Trail Network, and we will be in charge of these trails. We're still working out who maintains them, whatnot, but we're going to build them. The current trails that we have in Heber that are coming in, one we call the Rail Trail, which goes along the Heber Creeper, as I call it, the Heber Valley Railroad. And we have two sections of that we're going to put in. And then we also have on the, I guess I would call it the west side of, the northwest side of Deer Creek Reservoir. That one's a pretty long trail. That'll be a little while before we get that in. But the goal is to have 12-foot wide asphalt paved trails.
Wow. Well, that's very exciting. I'm sure trail users in Heber and the Wasatch County will be excited to hear that that's coming to the region.
Yeah, it is exciting.
Yeah. Wow. Well, never a dull moment with UDOT.
We try.
Well, thank you so much for all of the updates that you've shared this morning, Wyatt. Thanks for joining us.
You're welcome.
We've been speaking with UDOT's Wyatt Woolley. He's the Region 3 Communications Manager. You're listening to Local News Hour.
In breaking news, the Park City Mountain Ski Patrol Union went out on strike this morning. Resort representatives say the mountain is still open for skiing. The Park City Professional Ski Patrol Association says about 200 patrollers are participating in the strike. It's unclear how long it will last. Park City COO Deirdre Walsh previously told KPCW the mountain was prepared to deploy its patrol support team, which includes patrollers from Park City and other Vail-owned resorts, in the event of a strike. The union was scheduled to hold mediation talks with Vail Resorts representatives Thursday night as the two attempt to renegotiate a contract. Their previous contract expired in April. The parties reached a tentative agreement on education and training packages on December 18th, but continue to negotiate over wages. The union wants Park City Mountain owner Vail Resorts to raise the patroller's base wage from $21 to $23 per hour across all resorts to adjust for nationwide inflation. The group also wants Vail to increase compensation for the more experienced patrollers. According to Park City Mountain, patrol wages have increased more than 50% over the past four seasons, outpacing inflation. The union has also filed unfair labor practice complaints against Vail with National Labor Relations Board over delays in negotiations. Patrollers are picketing at Mountain Village, Canyons Village, and the intersection of Park Avenue and Deer Valley Drive from 7:30 until 5 p.m. today. This is a developing story and will be updated as we obtain more information. Once a month, we're lucky to be joined by Lauren Gustus, the executive editor of the Salt Lake Tribune. Today, we're going to take a look back at some of the most significant stories of 2024. Lauren, thanks for spending time with us.
Of course. How are you?
Good. Lauren, happy holidays. Let's start with the anti-DEI bill that was signed by Governor Cox in January. What did it do, and what do you think it tells us about the evolution of Spencer Cox?
That's an interesting question. So the bill requires that public entities essentially remove the words diversity, equity, and inclusion from their program names, that they open any specific race or gender-based efforts to all individuals. And so we've spent now as a state the better part of the last year working to scrub those components from public entities like universities, right? And so we cannot at universities ask applicants about their beliefs about DEI as part of the hiring process, right? Cox recently said that was bordering on evil for higher education. The results have been that for the most part, institutions have either found another way. So organizations that are affiliated with efforts to enshrine or ensure DEI benefits have either moved out of the traditional campus orbit, right? So they're hosting themselves essentially independently, or there are centers that are available for all and to all, not just, you know, one party or one group, if that makes sense. It really is a reversal for Spencer Cox, who focused a lot on equity when he was earlier in his career as a state leader, lieutenant governor, and governor. So it is quite the transition. It's not out of sync or out of step with others across the country, right? In that other states have done kind of the same thing, if you will. But previously, Cox had pushed for more female voices. He focused on, equity as an ideal, right, that we should be lifting up. So it has been quite the about face. And as we look ahead at 2025 and what the legislature will bring with respect to bills and ultimately, you know, bills that'll make their ways into laws, there's more coming for public universities. There's lots of conversations about how effective they are, how efficient they are. And there are a number of measures that we think we'll see related to what funding our public universities receive and for what activities.
I was going to ask you about that. Do the universities or do your reporters see the potential for a change, a further reduction in funding of public education by the state?
They're asking universities to find savings. It's not clear yet whether those savings will be applied elsewhere or whether they will be extracted from the university. So Speaker of the House Mike Schultz has said, we'd like universities to find about 10% in savings. And the media are not yet sure how that will play out as we move through this legislative session, which includes a budgeting component. But there are any number of directions that the ledge could take, including housing some of that money with USHE, which is the higher education, essentially, organization of the state. There could be withholding, you know, on a university-specific basis. We don't yet know enough to know how the funding will shake out.
It will keep your reporters covering the ledge busy next year, I suspect.
It sure will. It's already kept them busy.
Okay. One of the stories, I asked you about what some of the more significant stories. One of the things you included was the Republican Party caucus. Why do you think that was a significant story? And what does it tell us about the state of Utah's dominant political party?
Yeah, this got a little lost. Maybe, maybe not. A lot has happened since we held the Republican caucuses in March. But long story short, they didn't go well, right? And it was the second time that a Republican you know, caucus had really gone sideways in an election year, right? We had folks who waited in long lines, folks were confused about where they were supposed to go to vote, right? You were supposed to pre-register, but that was troublesome. And results for these caucus events, first round results, didn't come in till midnight, about 4 hours after the Democrats reported their results. And so I think it left people kind of feeling like, gosh, it's just hard to participate, right? And I think that's the last thing that either party ostensibly would want if they're looking at, you know, the process logically, right? And so later this year, there was supposed to be an audit, essentially a summary presented to lawmakers of how the caucus went in March. And lawmakers canceled that hearing. They said, no, we don't want to hear that. We're not ready for that. So we never got to have that conversation, I would say, out in the open. But it was a little bit of a precursor, too, to some of the activity that we saw in November, right, in some of the most conservative counties in our state. That would be in Washington County and in Utah County, where folks waited in long lines in the general election because there was some concern about the safety of mail-in voting that had been, I would say, wrongfully perpetuated by county clerks, specifically Utah County's clerk, and that's my opinion only. But the Utah County clerk specifically had a bit of a go of it on election night, and results were very late. People waited in very long lines, right? And so, you know, Utah on the whole has a good system if we choose to honor it, right? So can we look at how we choose to honor mail-in voting, how we choose to honor the vote counting process, how we choose to make sure that we're ready to roll. Utah County ran out of both paper and ink on election day.
Wow.
So long story short, we have some room for improvement there.
And, you know, a somewhat related story was the continuing sort of issues arising out of the distinction between what happens at the Republican convention in terms of the nomination for governor and what happened in the primary. That tension remains. And do you see any changes in what's going on?
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. Haven't heard much from lawmakers around making changes. I think there are people who would prefer to just be all primary and to not have to do the work at the caucus that they have to do. But there's a degree of control that current elected officials have with the caucus. And I think they like that. And therefore, they're probably reticent to let that go.
The battle over the power of voters to change laws through the initiative process sort of raged on in 2024. Where does that stand? What happened? And where are things likely to go from here?
It did. Amendment D was voided. Amendment A was on our ballots as well. We may have already forgotten, right? But D was supposed to give the legislature a lot more power in determining what initiatives get on the ballot. But the way that the language was written was misleading. And therefore, the Utah Supreme Court, just weeks before we voted, said, we can't stop this ballot initiative from appearing on ballots. It's already gone to the printers, but the votes won't be counted. So what that means is lawmakers in Utah have another 2 years before they can put something like that on the ballot again. And they've said, like, yeah, we probably were a little too, how do you want to say, off. They probably didn't use the word misleading in our language, and we need to do better. But in the interim, they've got two legislative sessions to work with, right? And so they're talking about what they might do in the session. Options range from raising the signature threshold for ballot measures, right? So you got to get more signatures in each county in Utah or in total, or to requiring 60% approval from some measures, and that's higher than our current standard, right? So we'll see what happens, but lawmakers have already said, yeah, we're going to look at this as we move into our legislative session, which starts in January.
And can things like raising the threshold be done by legislation without a constitutional amendment, or is that something they can do?
You know, I think it would be fair to say it depends on what they introduce, mm-hmm, right? So they have to start with proposed legislation unless we, as citizens, decided that we wanted to put an initiative on the ballot that raised the threshold, which I don't think we would.
No.
You know, anyhow, it kind of depends, I believe, on how we're wording that language and what it is that we're seeking to do. But they certainly have to start in the legislature.
Okay. That is a continuing subject of great interest, I think. No sort of discussion of significant stories would be complete without talking about the Olympics. The Olympics announcement is a big deal. But I want to ask you about it in terms of what it means for the potential redevelopment of downtown Salt Lake City.
Yeah, so I would say three big things happened downtown this year. One, we announced in July, in concert with our friends who were in Paris at the Summer Games, that Utah will get the Olympics in 2034, which is great news. Two, we picked up an NHL team kind of quickly, which is not an insignificant addition to our local sports landscape, right? And the NHL team is now playing where the Utah Jazz does, right, at Delta Center, which is both teams are owned by Smith Entertainment Group, which is Ryan Smith's company, Ryan and Ashley Smith. And then the legislature, as we move through this process of, you know, likely picking up an NHL team, said that, you know, there was some potential to revitalize downtown if these two teams, you know, ultimately did end up staying downtown. And the legislature said, you know, we'll give you up to $900 million in taxpayer funding, right, to support the redevelopment of three blocks downtown, which is a big deal. Obviously, Delta Center is on one of those blocks, then there's a couple others, right? And so that the legislature passed a bill that said this is possible. It went through all kinds of steps, both at the local level, i.e. with Salt Lake City, and back to the ledge. Long story short, it's a go, right? And so that work will begin and will be done hopefully by the time the 2034 Olympics arrive, right? But yeah, the Winter Games are a game changer with respect to both the redevelopment of downtown, as well as, you know, putting Utah on the map more broadly. It did in part incentivize the significant investment in downtown that Ryan Smith is making in conjunction with taxpayers. That doesn't even get at what's happening over in the Power District, which is an effort by the Larry H. Miller Group to bring Major League Baseball to Salt Lake City. So lots and lots to talk about with respect to the reimagining, if you will, of downtown Salt Lake City, which will happen in the next 10 years or so. And a lot of progress is made on that this year.
And at this point, is Abravanel Hall going to remain? There was some talk about
moving. Oh, great question. How could we forget the Abravanel Hall? So for now, as I understand it, Abravanel Hall is not, how do I want to say this? I don't get the sense that it's final, but there's been no move or no play to say we're going to pick it up and move it over here, right, or we're going to rebuild it or whatnot. Folks seem to be doing their best to hold on to Abravanel Hall. There's a lot of appreciation, a lot of love for Abravanel, and while the cost to rehabilitate it is not insignificant, I think it's about $200 million, there are many folks who want it to stay put and to continue to serve Utahns.
Let's touch on a couple of major criminal stories covered by the Tribune this year. First, let's talk about Samuel Bateman, and then we'll get to Tabor and Honey.
Sure. So Samuel Bateman is a self-declared prophet who was living down on the Utah-Arizona border, and this year was sentenced, just actually last month, sentenced to 50 years in federal prison after acknowledging that he had spiritually married 20 wives, including 10 underage girls. And he said, you know, his intent in marrying them was to engage in sexual activity. So, you know, manipulating faith, right, for personal advantage, if you will, and committing crimes in the process. He gave wives away to other adult male followers who's part of the FLDS church, kind of tried to take over as Warren Jeffs was in prison, right? And so the good news is, you know, Bateman will be imprisoned now for 50 years. And then, you know, should he ever, you know, have the opportunity to leave, he'll be monitored for the rest of his life. And his victims are no longer under the spell or control, right, of. And the Tribune did a lot of really good reporting on this. We cultivated some sources in the community over a period of years, and I'd encourage your folks to check out some of the long form video and reporting that Jessica Miller and Trent Nelson have done over the course of months and years on this effort. Really sensitive story.
Lauren, before we go, the Tribune has been a nonprofit newspaper since 2019, and it was really the first major paper to go and do that. Can you discuss a bit about the kinds of expenses it takes to run a paper like the Trib, your main sources of revenue?
Yeah, thanks. So, you know, we've got the expenses one might assume that a newspaper has in printing the paper, right, and distributing it in ink for the paper. But our biggest cost by far is our labor cost. And I think that's really important and also really wonderful, right? We invest as much as we can in sharing stories that Utah needs to hear, right? And so, you know, if you look at the size of our staff, we're about 60 in our newsroom. That includes everyone from video journalists to the people who design the print paper. And, you know, we are doing everything we can to make sure that we have the revenue sources that will enable us to support those reporting efforts. And so that's advertising, that is subscription revenue, and it's increasingly philanthropy. And now is the time, if you're thinking about supporting any causes at the end of the year, to think about local news, be it KPCW or the Tribune, or if you're fortunate enough to be able to consider both, please do. I think there's an incredible public service that these entities provide. And I think that, you know, what we're finding is that, you know, people are happy to support us. They want to help. And we are so grateful for that. And if that is you, then, you know, we would welcome you with open arms if you are indeed open to support this season.
And what's the best way for them to reach out to you if they're interested in you're in giving to the Tribune? Yeah.
Thanks, Roger. It's sltrib.com/donate.
Lauren, thanks for spending time with us. Happy New Year, and we'll pick this up in a month.
Thanks, Roger. You too.
And once again, a breaking story. The Park City Mountain Ski Patrol Union has gone on strike this morning. Resort representatives say the mountain is still open for skiing. The Park City Professional Ski Patrol Association says about 200 patrollers are participating in the strike. It's unclear how long it will last. Park City Mountain COO Deirdre Walls previously told KPCW the mountain was prepared to deploy its patrol support team, which includes patrollers from Park City and other Vail-owned resorts, in the event of a strike. The union was scheduled to hold mediation talks with Vail Resort representative Thursday night as the two attempt to renegotiate a contract. The previous contract expired in April. The parties reached a tentative agreement on education and training packages on December 18th, but continued to negotiate over wages. The union wants Park City Mountain owner Vail Resorts to raise the patroller's base wage from $21 to $23 per hour across all resorts to adjust for nationwide inflation. The group also wants Vail to increase compensation for more experienced patrollers. According to Park City Mountain, patrol wages have increased more than 50% over the last four seasons, outpacing inflation. The union has also filed unfair labor practices complaints against Vail with the NLRB over delays in negotiations. You can see picketing at Mountain Village, Canyons Village, and the intersection of Park Avenue and Deer Valley from 7:30 until 5 p.m. Friday.